The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays at 1 to 2 p.m. and Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. on KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon. You can stream the station worldwide at KORCFM.com, where you can also make a secure online contribution that supports independent community radio in Corvallis. And if you'd like to help us tell the news each week, send an email to info@KORCFM.com. We will be in touch.
What's the South Corvallis Food Hub Project, you ask? Well, a food hub is a bridge connecting local food producers to consumers, making our food system stronger, boosting economic opportunities for farmers, and giving communities access to fresh, local products. The city has undertaken a study to create a South Corvallis food hub. How does it work? A food system starts with local farmers who grow nutritious food for local consumers. They may process foods or sell through a farmer's market or to wholesale products to distributors. The farmers provide a steady flow of products to willing consumers, all locally. A food hub starts in the fields where producers grow their products and then bring them to market. By selling locally, consumers have a steady source of food, and CO2 emissions are reduced because food is both grown, processed, and consumed locally, eliminating long-distance trucking. So a food hub helps sustainable living. Additionally, there are no pesticides or other chemicals required to extend shelf life. Grown, delivered, and consumed in a short period of time, all locally, a food hub can also create relationships between local growers and local restaurants, schools, and other large organizations in their community. This process is a win-win for growers, consumers, and the environment. Currently, there's a feasibility study being undertaken for a South Corvallis food hub. South Corvallis has traditionally had an industrial focus. Later on, Southtown's focus became residential, specifically affordable residences. The city continues to focus on South Corvallis as a residential center, but clearly there are issues with that, and most of them center around food and shopping. To quote Rebecca Weinsteiger, principal in charge at Weinsteiger Consulting, which is leading the research and development efforts for a project seeking to address the area's shortfalls. She says, most residents drive up to 8 miles round trip to access more resource-rich areas of town to meet their shopping needs. This could mean a couple of bus rides for those who cannot afford or access a car. These challenges come together to result in what many have called a food desert, an urban area where high-quality or affordable food is harder to access. This desert is somewhat an odd disparity because it exists in an oasis of food producers and entrepreneurs. In August 2021, the City of Corvallis, through the Benton County Economic Development Office, received a $550,000 American Rescue Plan Act grant from the state to identify and plug gaps in food and beverage supply in the South Corvallis area. With a December 2024 deadline to use these dollars looming, city and county staff, consultants, food businesses, and community stakeholders are looking to develop and implement a financially viable food hub to address food access challenges in Southtown. It's a long-standing problem, and efforts to address food access challenges in South Corvallis date as far back as 16 years, if not longer. In 2008, Benton County, with the help of various partners, including OSU, launched a project called Creciendo en Salud, with the goal, in part, to address inadequate access to affordable, culturally appropriate food for the area's Latino communities. A subsidized farmers market at Lincoln Elementary School started about the same time through the Healthy Youth Program, an initiative of the Linus Pauling Institute. The market lasted for 2 seasons. Food hubs, on the other hand, are a growing feature of building resilient food systems across the country. They're structured in various ways or have features similar to the ideas developed for the food center, such as farmers markets or food cart pod components. However, food hubs are designed to create more economic avenues for food producers, including farmers, ranchers, processors, and commercial buyers, to take their products and services to consumers. The current studies will include a literature review of all previous studies as well as economic and business analyses. The first phase of the Food Hub project, which began in earnest early this year, is an ongoing survey and feasibility study to better understand what is topmost on the list of today's needs. With limited funding and no assurance of future funding, it's crucial that the model the consultants develop is financially viable outright. While new construction is out of the picture in light of available funds, leasing options are on the table. In January, project consultants said what was emerging from the 500-plus responses to a survey showed that the four salient needs for food producers and processors were the desire for a local food aggregator, a directory of local food producers, a delivery system, a shared storage space, especially cold storage. For consumers, their needs included the desire for more locally sourced or produced food and affordability. Consumers also expressed interest in a hub model that included a farmer's market and a food cart pod. In addition to the feasibility study and report, consultants are also developing an inventory of available equipment and infrastructure that could potentially inform what model the food hub takes. Once the city and county leaders give approval, the next phase of the project, which consultants say is already in motion, will be to establish partnership with an operator and begin tapping the grant to develop the hub. South Corvallis and Benton County are agriculturally rich, and there are urban farmers and farms outside the urban growth boundary. A food hub could support local farmers to keep local food production viable. You can get involved by starting at southcorvallisfoodhub.com. And by attending the next meeting of the project at 6 p.m., Thursday, April 25th, at the Tunison Meeting Room, 365 Southwest Tunison in Corvallis. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
Clem Stark, local poet of the working person, passed away on March 21st. His longtime friend and fellow writer, Charles Goodrich, said this on his Facebook: "The fabric of physicality parted briefly last Thursday, and my great friend Clem Stark slipped through." Clem lived a life working with his hands and mind to alter the world around him. Whether it was writing words on a page or putting 2x4s together, he was no stranger to the creative force that flows through the human soul. I had the opportunity to sit down and interview Clem last fall in his home outside of Dallas, Oregon. The sun shone upon the bare branches of the autumn trees around his house, a house which he built himself from the ground up. In remembrance of his life and work, we're going to air that interview now. Thanks for listening.
New neighbors, building a house up on the hill. She raises goats, he works at the pen. From my back door, it's 30 miles as the crow flies. Over the mountains to the coast. It used to be I could imagine walking it.
I didn't know of Clem Stark or of his work before 2017 when I just happened to go into Grassroots to check out this poetry reading one night. And after a couple speakers, up walked this guy. He must have been in his 70s. White beard, bald-headed, broad-shouldered. And began reading in this slow, methodical way poems about carpentry, about laying concrete, building bridges, using everyday language. I guess, for lack of a better word, non-poetic language. It was different from the poetry I heard at the time. And so, I remembered his name, and looked him up. Turns out, he worked at OSU, as a carpenter, for a couple decades before retiring in the early aughts. He released books of poetry in the 90s. His first one, Journeyman's Wages, won the Oregon Book Award. He's been a visiting poet at two universities and has received accolades from the Oregonian and the New York Times. I recently had the opportunity to go sit down with Clem at his home and talk about his life and work. Here he is, talking about how he first came to the area. Let's listen.
And I was looking for a place where I could build a house and raise my family. I'm a carpenter by trade and wound up looking through British Columbia and then other places in the Northwest, Washington, Idaho, Montana, finally came down to Oregon, and just happened to find this place where I live now. So that was 47 years ago, 1976.
And you've been in this spot, this
I've been in this very house since then. This house we're sitting in was a completely falling down, dilapidated old farmhouse, 19th century farmhouse. Mm-hmm. It was considered of no value whatsoever. I bought the land and bought this wreck of a house and basically totally rebuilt it over the years.
Building and crafting are major themes in Clem's work. Throughout pretty much most of his adult life, he's been building things. It's how he sustained himself.
I became a carpenter back in San Francisco in the early 60s.
Okay.
Went through the apprenticeship program in San Francisco. Worked out of Carpenters Local 483. You know, I was a union, union carpenter. And so when I moved here in 76, I transferred my book, my union credentials, from the San Francisco local, which and I had, when I worked in Canada, I was working non-union. I built houses in Canada too, but as a non-union carpenter. But I kept my dues up with the San Francisco local, so I moved my book to the Salem local. So I worked out of the Salem local Local 1065. So most of my jobs, well, my jobs were all over the valley, but Corvallis was like out of the Salem district for the union. So I never worked in Corvallis until at one point, and this was during that 10-year period before I went to work at OSU, jobs were scarce in the early 80s. You know, there was a recession. And jobs out of the union hall were few and far between. So I wound up working with a partner, tearing down buildings, houses, barns, and selling the lumber for salvage, where I got to Corvallis. That's how I worked in Corvallis.
So then
I went to work at OSU in 86.
86, okay. Now, long before he started working at OSU and long before he moved to the area, Clem had cemented his love and dedication to the art of writing poetry.
Well, let's back up a little bit. I started writing in 1959 when I was living in San Francisco. Well, no, even before that. I was living in New York. I started writing in New York. I was living in Manhattan.
You know. When you were doing reporting, correct?
When I was working on the oil paint, the newspaper.
Yeah.
Trade Weekly. Yeah, so that was 59, 60, 61. And then I left New York because I got, after I had started, you know, I had started writing poetry. And I got a scholarship, a fellowship to a artist's foundation in New Mexico. So I went and I lived in Taos, New Mexico, for a year writing. And then from there, I moved to San Francisco with my then wife, was my first wife. Mm-hmm. You know? So we moved to San Francisco, and writing was the focus of my life. I mean, I basically, everything else I did was part of my aim, my focus, to write. So anyway, I spent, that's when I became a carpenter, after I got into the Bay Area in San Francisco, and went through the apprenticeship program, became a carpenter as a way of supporting myself as a poet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's basically was my...
Now, Clem's livelihood was carpentry, and he seemed to dedicate himself to the craft just as much as he did to his craft of poetry. I mean, just sitting in his house, you can tell it was built with great care and attention, much like choosing the words he uses to put in his poems.
Was that poetry and carpentry were very similar in the sense of taking raw materials and putting them together, fashioning them into some form. And also I had a sense early on that I was following an ancient ancient trade. I had a sense of myself following in the, not just the footsteps, but in the mode, I guess, of a centuries-old trade.
Mm.
You know, it was almost a fellow feeling, a certain bonding over time with other men who had done the same thing, used their hands, their bodies in the same way.
Mm.
Very similar to what I felt about poetry, that I was simply following other men who had done the same thing, to make things, makers of sorts.
And throughout the interview, that theme came up, that theme of being just part of a thread through time, of doing something you love, thinking about people who did it 2,000 years ago, who will do it 2,000 years from now, connected through time by a common task, so that when you sit down to write a poem today about, say, a tree in your backyard, is no different from the ancient Chinese poet Cold Mountain sitting next to a lake writing about the moon. Anyway, there's so much more that Clem and I talked about that I wish I could put in here, but I want to end this show with a poem of his that he read to me after our interview. Here's Clem reading his poem, Dismantling, from his book, Journeyman's Wages.
Call Joel, evenings, 623-9765. Smack in the public eye at 9th and Van Buren, tearing down an old house. Not demolition, dismantling, says Joel. Slowly, we make the house disappear. It takes a few months. We do this for a living. Our sign says, used lumber for sale. Neat stacks of it on the front lawn, around a dormant forsythia, shiplap and siding. And over here, we have two-by. That pile is already sold. We also have toilets, sinks, remarkable savings on bent nails, French doors, free kindling, and more, lots more. With the roof off, a house looks more like a cathedral, rafters outlined against the sky. A pair of ragged priests, stick by stick, we celebrate nothing. We are making the shape of nothing, creating an absence. And when we have finished, what will there be at 9th and Van Buren? A square of bare earth where a house was. Sidewalk, foundation, concrete stoop. Two steps up, and you're there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Beautiful. Be a poet? I never thought about being a poet. I always wrote poetry. What did I have to think about? No decision was necessary. This is a mistake that people make when they say, when did you decide you're going to be? Well, you don't decide things like that. You do it.
That last voice you heard was Canadian poet Al Purdy. Clem Stark passed away Thursday, March 21st, the first day of spring. He was 86. You're listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC. Hi, everyone. This is JC, and I'm going to read a segment from Jeff Tiedrich from his Substack, Everyone is Entitled to My Own Opinion. Arizona's forced birth fascist revive abortion ban from 1864. Arizona Republicans own this law. Let's make them pay for it. Terminally annoying fringe weirdo Carrie Lake the once and future failed candidate for office in Arizona, is running around in a total panic right now. Here's why. Only one day after little Donnie put out that video lauding the brilliance of having states rule over women's health care, Arizona Supreme Court done gone and individuals stated the shit out of reproductive choice. Headline: Today, Arizona's highest court in a 4-2 decision upheld an Arizona law dating from 1864 that bans nearly all abortions. The law, which was on the books long before Arizona achieved statehood, outlaws abortion from the moment of conception, except when necessary to save the life of the mother. It makes no exceptions for rape or incest. Doctors prosecuted under the law could face fines and prison terms of 2 to 5 years. Way to go, Arizona Supreme Court! Ace job criminalizing access to health care by reviving a century and a half old law. That's right. It's a fucking territorial law. Wrap your mind around that. A territorial law written in 1864. Arizona didn't become a state until 1912. Carrie Lake is apoplectic. Quote, "I oppose today's ruling, and I am calling on Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs and the state legislature to come up with an immediate common sense solution that Arizonans can support," unquote. All the way off, Carrie. You see, flip-flop Carrie was for the 1864 ban before she was against it. Headline: During the 2024 debate, Lake said that she hoped that the Supreme Court would quote-unquote do the right thing and overturn Roe. She then talked about what would happen in Arizona if that happened. Quote, "We have a great law on the books right now. If that happens, we will be a state where we will not be taking the lives of our unborn anymore," unquote. That was then. But Lake and her confederates now realize that abortion rights are wildly popular and forced birth fascism is political arsenic. Crazy Eyes Carrie is currently a candidate for U.S. Senate. So what was hailed as a great law that's on the books right now is suddenly something she quote-unquote opposes. Flippity-floppity. Carrie Lake is not the only Arizona Republican trying to have it both ways. Here's former Governor Doug Ducey. Quote, "I signed the 15-week law as governor because it is thoughtful conservative policy and an approach to this very sensitive issue that Arizonans can actually agree on. The ruling today is not the outcome I would have preferred, and I call on our elected leaders to heed the will of the people and address this issue with a policy that is workable and reflective of our electorate," unquote. Doug, please join Carrie Lake in fucking off all the way to Pakistan. What Ducey hopes you don't remember is that the 15-week law he signed in 2022 stated clearly that if Roe v. Wade was overturned, the 2022 law would go away in favor of the 1864 law. On top of that, Ducey appointed 5 of the 7 justices who currently comprise Arizona's Supreme Court, and all 5 of them voted in favor of the 1864 ban. Arizona Republicans own this law, and it's time to make them pay for it. Reproductive rights activists in Arizona want to put abortion on the ballot this November. Headline: Arizona for Abortion Access, a coalition of reproductive rights groups, says they've collected enough signatures to get their measure on the ballot. They've gathered more than 500,000 signatures, over 120,000 more signatures than they need, with months to go before the July 3rd deadline. The proposed amendment would protect abortion rights in the state constitution up until fetal viability, after which someone could end a pregnancy if their life, physical, or mental health was endangered. Of course, not every Arizona Republican is in hiding today. The Arizona Freedom Caucus is fully on board with this shit. And I quote, statement on Arizona Supreme Court's pro-life ruling. Today, the Supreme Court of Arizona made the correct ruling, upheld the intent of the legislature, and preserved the rule of law today by ruling that the pre-Roe law will remain effective. What is it with these Freedom Caucus folks? How Orwellian is it that the only freedom that these pukes are interested in is the freedom to take away yours? Now check out Mark Simone, a conservative radio host on Fox News, and I quote, "If you had to travel to another state to get an abortion, it's not the worst thing in the world. Buying a bus ticket to go somewhere to get it is not the worst thing in the world," unquote. You heard right, little Miss 10-year-old rape victim. Just hop on a bus. I'm sure the stepfather who raped you will pay for your ticket. It's that easy. Now dry your eyes and quit complaining. And now a little bit of good news. Quote, Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell says in a statement she will not prosecute women who obtain abortions under the 1864 territorial law. And Arizona's Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays also vowed not to enforce the law. Well, keep it up, folks. Keep forcing 10-year-olds to give birth to their rapist babies. Keep outlawing IVF. Keep shoving antiquated laws down our throats. Keep telling women that if they don't like it, they can just get on a bus. You dipshits have kicked a hornet's nest. Look around, find out. This is JC, and I just read Jeff Tiedrich's Everyone is Entitled to My Own Opinion. You're listening to KORC.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics, a program that you can hear every Sunday from 1 to 2, and every Monday from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. This is Dan Kroll. I am on site. I'm here at the corner of Southwest 3rd and Crystal Lake Drive. I drive past this corner quite often, and for at least the last 6 months I have been meaning to get out and scrape off this Let's Go Brandon sticker. I've been eyeing it. I will take credit. I have scraped off other Let's Go Brandon stickers around town off of stop signs and other infrastructure. Public infrastructure where that unfunny, unclever phrase does not belong. And when I look at this pole where this Let's Go Brandon sticker is, I realize this is a small difference. I've been wanting to do this for like 6 months, and here I am at the pole. I've got my stepladder, I'm going to set it down. I've got in my right hand a razor. You can scrape off a sticker, and in my left hand I'm holding this recording device. And I've wanted to record this because I see it as a civics lesson. There are a lot of things in our town and our world that need the attention of civics-minded people, small and large. And it's one little area I can make a difference. Let's go, Brandon. It is the mating call of the loser.
scraping it off. It's in front of this business here. I'm surprised they've allowed it to stay on the pole that's very prominently seen in front of their business. I've been wanting to scrape this off ever since I saw it like 6 months ago. And this isn't my job, but I have made it my job, scraping it off right now. It's coming off slowly because it's really made its way on here with rain and sunlight. Although, maybe not sunlight, it's on the north side of this pole. But, yeah, I'm sick of looking at it. And I was able to scrape a whole bunch of these off over on 5th Street about 8 months ago. And an employee of the local mechanic shop, car dealership, came out and asked, "What are you doing?" So I was removing a Let's Go Brandon sticker. And I got the sense that he may have been the one who put it up. If this was on private property, I wouldn't have anything to do. I wouldn't touch it. I don't touch private property. But this is a public pole. It'd be nice if we had the public works folks out here scraping this, or ODOT, I don't know. Or any number of entities would be out here scraping this off. But you know what? They haven't. And I've decided to make this my business because I drive by here pretty often and I look at signs, I look at stickers, I notice these little details. But, you know, there's already enough litter out there. Let's go, Brandon. Gosh, that is a phrase that whether we like it or not, we're going to be hearing for years due to lack of originality and sense of humor. Hey, I'm no big fan of Joe Biden for a number of reasons, but yeah. Almost got it completely scraped off. Sticker's really adhering to this pole, but I am diligently scraping it off. It's just a small difference. I used to spend a lot of time cleaning up cigarette butts. I've actually been written up in the paper more than once for my cigarette cleanup efforts because I made a bunch of noise about it. Our city has gotten really trashed lately, so I feel like it's almost in vain trying to clean up the cigarettes. I feel defeated on that one. Though today I might go and clean up some cigarettes near sewage drainage areas because I don't like the idea of them going into the waterways. There's really no other... I mean, I know that if I go and sweep it up myself, that it will be taken care of. And I will say that having done that in the past, I've made myself feel a lot better. I know it's a small difference and can't save the entire planet in one foul swoop. Takes a lot of us, though, to be that counterbalance that you know the world needs. And it's not always easy. We've all got responsibilities, our life to live. And I'm glad that I just removed that Let's Go Brandon sticker from the corner of Southeast Crystal Lake Drive and Southeast 3rd Street, or would this be Southwest 3rd, Highway 99. Sick of looking at it. And I guess the point of recording this, not that you could hear me scraping it off the pole, get back into my vehicle here and out of the noisy sea of engine sounds outside. I feel like it's important to act on those things that you know need attention. You can't count on someone else to do it. Sometimes you can, but if you care about any issue, whether it's garbage on the ground, garbage in our waterways, in this case, garbage on public utility poles, you can do something about it. And you know what that is. I know it's a small drop in the bucket, but I'm happy to contribute and encourage you to go out and be that counterbalance that you know the world needs. This is Dan Krall for KORC News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. As part of our civics programming, KORC includes a weekly segment from Democracy Now! This segment that you'll hear will include international and national news from April 12, 2024.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The trilateral summit will lead to the installation of foreign military bases, intensified foreign military build-up, and it will also lead to the escalation of conflict in the West Philippine Sea and in Asia Pacific.
Protests in the Philippines as President Biden hosts a first-of-its-kind trilateral summit at the White House with the leaders of the Philippines and Japan as tensions grow with China. We'll speak with acclaimed Filipino scholar and activist Walden Bello. Then Ukraine's parliament passes a contested bill to expand the military draft as the Russian invasion stretches into its third year with no end in sight.
The front line has settled into something of a stalemate and an attritional grind with catastrophic losses on both sides. And it's become somewhat of a contest of resources. And one of the resources is men, soldiers.
We'll speak with New Yorker magazine war correspondent Luke Mogelson. He's winning the prestigious George Polk Award today. It's his third in 4 years. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli attacks across Gaza have killed dozens of Palestinians over the past day, including in the Nusayrat refugee camp, Gaza City, and Rafah. Palestinian officials say an Israeli airstrike killed Ridwan Ridwan, the head of the Jabalia camp's police force, who oversaw the safe travel of aid truck convoys in northern Gaza. Like much of the Gaza Strip, Jabalia has been left in utter ruins by Israel. Children are forced to play among the rubble.
We built this game because all of our toys have been destroyed, and our houses have been destroyed, and there's nothing for us to play with except this pipe.
As you can see here at the Jabalia refugee camp, mass destruction. There isn't an atmosphere of Eid or the joy that comes with it. As you can see, children are playing on the rubble and rocks, and I am entertaining them.
On Wednesday, Samantha Power, head of USAID, became the first top Biden administration official to publicly acknowledge famine is present in northern Gaza. She was questioned by House Democrat Joaquin Castro during a congressional hearing.
So there's a famine is already occurring there.
That is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Congressmember Castro then asked Samantha Power how many children were at risk of dying in the coming weeks due to famine in Gaza.
In northern Gaza, the rate of malnutrition prior to October 7th was almost zero, and it is now one in three kids.
The Biden administration sent top military commander General Michael Correa to Israel and has restricted travel for its embassy staff in Israel as fears mount over a possible Iranian attack. The Wall Street Journal reported Thursday an attack in Israel could come by Saturday, though another unnamed source says Tehran has not made any final decisions. Iranian leadership vowed to retaliate following last week's Israeli attack on the diplomatic site in Damascus, Syria, which killed top Iranian military officials, including Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a senior commander in the Al-Quds force. In Morocco, an activist was sentenced to 5 years in prison this week for criticizing Morocco's 2020 decision to normalize relations with Israel. Abdulrahman Zankad was arrested last month after posting on Facebook his criticism. Mexico's filed a complaint with the International Court of Justice and requested the UN expel Ecuador as tensions between the two nations rise. Last week, Ecuadorian police and military raided the Mexican embassy in Quito to arrest former leftist Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass. He had been taking refuge at the embassy since December to avoid arrest on corruption charges, which he and allies say are politically motivated. This is Mexico's Foreign Secretary, Alicia Bárcena.
Mexico is accusing Ecuador of violating the diplomatic immunity of its embassy, and this is extremely serious, regardless of the cause. The fact that they have raided the embassy in a violent manner with police and military forces is a violation and justified anywhere.
Ukraine passed a bill overhauling the military draft as a general warned lawmakers Russian forces outnumbered Ukrainian troops tenfold in the east. The new measures seek to increase troops by requiring eligible men update their draft data with authorities, increasing compensation for volunteers, and allowing some people with convictions to serve. It also does not set an upper limit for wartime military service. Lawmakers, however, were forced to remove some of the harshest draft-dodging penalties after public backlash. Family members of deployed soldiers protested the bill near the parliament in Kyiv Thursday.
Our boys and girls in the service are very tired. They have been fighting for 2 years, and no one is planning to replace them. For rotation to happen, newcomers have to know how much time they'll have to spend at the front line. Undefined mobilization terms mean fighting forever. Without strictly defined terms, no one will join the army.
The measure comes over 2 years into Russia's invasion of Ukraine and as Russian forces step up their attacks. Russia launched over 40 missiles and 40 drones at Ukrainian energy sources and critical infrastructure overnight Thursday, destroying at least one large electricity plant. We'll have more on Ukraine later in the broadcast. Polish lawmakers have begun debating reforms to Poland's near-total abortion ban, more than 3 years after mass protests against the ban rocked Poland. Poland's liberal new Prime Minister Donald Tusk pledged to bring abortion rights back, but his wide-ranging political coalition remains deeply divided on the issue. This is Dorota Oko of the Left Together Party.
Removing the provisions on imprisonment for assisting in abortion from the penal code is the first necessary step to the safety of pregnant women in our country. The place of abortion is in the medical textbook, not in the criminal code.
President Biden today announced another $7.4 billion in federal student loan relief. Around 277,000 borrowers will see their debt canceled as part of regulatory updates to existing programs. The new push will mostly benefit borrowers enrolled in SAVE, an income-driven repayment plan which relieves debt after at least 10 years of repayments. The Biden administration finalized a rule closing the gun show loophole. Vendors who sell firearms online at gun shows and through private purchases will now be required to conduct background checks on buyers. The change is expected to affect over 20,000 people who currently deal in unlicensed firearm sales. They'll also be required to register with the government. Far-right House conservatives blocked legislation that would extend warrantless surveillance after Donald Trump directed them to, quote, kill it. The move was in defiance of embattled House Speaker Mike Johnson, who's now failed three times to reauthorize Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. In Mississippi, six white former sheriff's deputies who belong to the self-described goon squad have each been sentenced in state court to 15 to 45 years in prison for raiding a home and torturing two black men. They'll serve the state sentences concurrently with their federal sentences, which were handed down last month and range between 10 and 40 years in prison. To see our full coverage of the story, and including interviews with the survivors, Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker, go to democracynow.org. In Australia, conservationists warn the Great Barrier Reef could be suffering its most severe coral bleaching ever. Some 75% of the reef has bleached in the fifth such event in 8 years, which are increasing with global heating. Coral reefs are key to maintaining marine biodiversity as thousands of underwater creatures depend on them for survival, including fish, sea turtles, seabirds, jellyfish, among many more. They also protect coastal areas from major storm surges and provide livelihoods and nourishment for surrounding communities and beyond. And in Nigeria, communities are marking 10 years since the mass kidnapping of 276 girls from their school dormitory in Chibok by Boko Haram fighters. Negotiations in 2016 and 17 led to the release of about 100 of the girls, but Nigerian and international leaders have since ceased campaigning for the release of the remaining captives as mass kidnappings continue to plague Nigeria. Their families and freed survivors are demanding their safe return.
Those that remain in the bush, they are my friends. So they are my friends. So I was praying, maybe one day we still see each other. I was praying that maybe government will help us and try their best so that they will come and see their parents. The parents will see their children the way we see our own parents.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Pansin sa iyong mga kapaligiran, kay dumi na ng hangin, pati na ang mga ilog natin. Hindi na masama ang pagkulat at malayo-layo na rin ang ating narating. Ngunit masdan mo ang tubig sa dagat, dati kulay asul, ngayon naging itim. Ang mga duming ating ikinalat sa hangin.
Observe the environment by a scene. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Sharifa Bokadous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
That was the Democracy Now! Segment from April 12, 2024. For more information on international and national news, go to democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC.
Listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard Sundays from 1 to 2 and Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. This is Dan Krall in the Southtown studio, joined today by Brian Steinhauser. He is the business liaison for the Early Learning Hub, Family Resources and Education Center of Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln County. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So the type of work that you do deals with child care.
That is correct. Corvallis and the rest of Benton counties and Lynn and Lincoln as well. I'm the business liaison, so I work with employers to try to get them to invest in child care for their employees and the overall community, as well as acting as a child care accelerator for the area, where I just work to increase the capacity of child care.
For young working parents or maybe single parents, child care can be a challenge, especially if you have kids who are not in school, kids who are preschool age, and that can sometimes put a real strain on the earnings, the overall month to month.
You couldn't be more true on that. I mean, the average cost for child care in the state of Oregon is roughly $13,000 per child. It's generally more
per year.
Per year, yes, and it's more. It's generally decided that. Upon that, it's more expensive than most public university tuitions. So, for instance, infant rates, the average monthly rate in the in Corvallis for infants is $1,600, which comes out to $19,000 and change per year, just for one child in infant care.
And of course, when we went through the pandemic, a number of us started to work from home or lost our jobs or changed our work routine entirely. But there are still folks who have to go to work or commute, and childcare is, they have to think about this.
Oh, absolutely. It's not just difficult to find because of just knowing where the resources are, but it's also a matter of just the lack of capacity, which is having major effects on Corvallis as a whole.
Talk about the work that your organization is doing regarding this problem.
Sure. So we have a couple projects going on. So we're working on the expansion of both center and family-based programs. So there's multiple different types of child care. So that the two predominantly that we're involving in is preschool, which is socialization and kindergarten preparedness. And then there's what is commonly referred to as daycare, though in our industry we don't use that term anymore because it's seen as not really valuing the educational experience and knowledge of the providers. So we're referring to it as just child care. So that, and that's all day care for children that can be as young as 8 weeks old, that can generally up to kindergarten age once they get into the K through 12 school system. Inadvertently, and what a lot of parents found out through COVID was that the K through 12 school system also acts as child care. But what my focus on is child care for working families. So that is the exact situation where someone wants to go to work, a single parent, a working parent, dual income parent, families where both of them want to go to work. And for that, they need to find child care, which is quite challenging. So we're working to build it up.
Do you have a website that provides child care resources for your clients?
Yeah, if they wanted to find childcare, there's a lot of different resources that they could use. For those who are computer savvy and diligent, they can go on findchildcareoregon.org and search for what they need. If not, they can call 211 and get live operator assistance to go through the same database. I will say that information that they'll get is limited based on the search parameters. They're only going to get a name and phone number. I will say as a pro tip that and this is coming from someone who's not just in the system as an employee, but also as a parent of 5-year-old twins who have been in child care since they're little babies. And if you've ever called the child care provider and they didn't answer their phone or they didn't return your message, it's because they're with the children. And you got to leave messages, and you got to call them as many times as you can. Get on as many waiting lists as you can. Because right now the average waiting list in Corvallis is actually 18 months, with a lot of recommendations to parents to get on the waiting list as soon as they conceive.
Not even pregnant yet. Now might be the time to get on that waiting list if that's in the plans.
Yeah, it's a sad situation when that's coming straight from like the OBGYNs to the new parents that are just get on that waiting list, because it might be fast, it might be slow, but you want to get on as many as you can. to try to ensure that you have that slot prepared, especially infants. There are no infant toddler slots currently open in the entire city.
Which, in an ideal setting, a parent can stay home with their infant. I mean, that is those are the formative years for sure. I can say for myself, I've been self-employed since my oldest, who is now 14, since he was born. And I am a fortunate tale to be told. Part of why I took up a bicycle taxi business as opposed to commuting to Portland to work at a radio station I used to work at, I started a bicycle taxi business here in Corvallis. And it was okay. It went all right for 10 years. But I did that for a number of reasons. One of the top three would have been so I could stay home with my child and each day get to experience them. Again, not everyone is that fortunate. There are working parents out there who there's no option. They have to go to work. They can't work from home. And your organization, Brian Steinhauser, works to help these parents.
That we do. So I'm currently working involved in two different expansion projects right now in Corvallis for center-based care. One with Little Beavers Preschool. They're on the north side of town, and they are currently working to expand their classrooms to gain up between 16 and 30 slots. And then I'm working with one of the local employers, Starker Forest, and they are doing an on-site child care program on their premises for their employees with excess seats that are slots that are going to the community at large, which is great news. In addition, we are also working on and have developed a home-based child care recruitment campaign called Growing Care. So that's growingcare.org. And that is to motivate just people who love children and who want to make a business out of it. We can assist them with access to startup grants, with business training, with college scholarships for certifications or degrees, as well as just long-term coaching and mentoring.
We're speaking with Brian Steinhauser. He is the business liaison for the Early Learning Hub, Family Resources and Education Center of Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln Counties. Thanks for joining us today on KORC. Do you have any other information you'd like to share with the public?
I do. Additional ways to find existing child care that are out there. One of them would be to go on Facebook, and there's a private group called Child Care in Corvallis, Oregon, and surrounding areas. Get permission, post your needs on there, and you'll be able to find not just licensed care, but also license exempt nannies, babysitters, au pairs, and especially off-hour and weekend care. You're going to have a lot of trouble finding that through the official licensed care programs, but you'll be able to have a lot more luck there. And if you're unsure of what child care services that you need or like one-on-one assistance to find more options to include prenatal medical support, parenting classes, or home visiting services, contact PolyWog. That's a referral program run out of my office with your Early Learning Hub. So that's polywogfamily.org if you're going on the internet, or you can call them at 541-917-4884. They have a large sign posted up on Route 34.
How did you get into this line of work?
That's an interesting question because I do not have a background in child care. I moved to Oregon in 2021 and was just looking for work, and they were looking for someone to fill this position that actually didn't have a child care background. They wanted someone who had experience in the private sector. And I applied, and it's been the best job I've ever had. It's probably the most important thing I've ever done. I actually come from a military experience as an infantryman in the Army. I had 11 years of experience as a non-commissioned officer. So this is a night and day difference from that, but I'm doing important things. I'm helping people. I'm helping families. I'm helping children. I'm helping other individuals who are just like myself, parents struggling to find childcare. I absolutely love what I do. I have independence. I have just I can be creative and develop new things, and I love it.
And in your line of work, what is a perfect, I don't want to say a perfect day, but what's a perfect scenario with a perfect outcome where you know, okay, I am doing something that is meaningful?
I learned from scratch. I got a grant writing for dummies book, and I learned how to write grants, and I pulled in over $200,000 in the last year with grant writing. So I love applying for a grant and knowing that I'm going to win it because I have a great argument to make supporting childcare. I love working with employers and finding out how much they're struggling and being able to point them at options to be able to help themselves and their employees. I love being able to help childcare providers who are struggling themselves and be able to point them in directions to better their businesses and their employees and to just to become more profitable and more successful. There's just so many pieces of what I'm doing that I just the outreach, knowing that I can, you know, communicating to the public, helping them in every way I can. And just, I love doing this job.
And when you obtain money through grants, what's a ballpark idea of where a lot of that money goes?
Pretty much all of it's going towards supporting growing care. So with the marketing costs, and we're offering our own pot of startup funds that we directly control ourselves, which is fantastic, because while there are some different statewide grant available programs that are available, we have no control on who gets those, whereas we can directly, we know the child care needs of this area better than anyone else, so we can direct the funding toward new programs, and the more that we can give out, the more successful they can be, because what we really want to do is, we don't want, especially home-based child care is not a cheap, it's cheaper than opening a center-based program, but there's still significant costs in there, and considering the importance of childcare and that there is money out there, it's our belief that no one should go into debt creating a childcare program. So that's our overall goal, is to be able to support childcare providers, to cover the costs of what it takes to create a successful business model and start watching kids and helping society and families and everyone else.
So given the current state of things in Corvallis today, would you say there is a need for more childcare providers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially home-based childcare. When it comes to registered family programs, Corvallis actually has less than even Lebanon does. It has about a third of what Albany does. It has more center-based programs than everyone else does. But a lot of that has to do with the housing cost. A lot of home-based childcare providers are low to moderate income levels, and just when you have a house that ranges from, you know, $400,000 to $800,000 with the mortgage and or the rent per month, it's really hard to make ends meet with a business model where the already you're struggling with profitability.
We're speaking with Brian Steinhauser, who is the business liaison for the Early Learning Hub Family Resources and Education Center of Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln County. If people wanted to get in touch with you, what is the best way?
My Early Learning Hub's website is LBL, earlylearninghub.org, and they have a section on there for the business outreach initiative, and that's the program that I run. And anyone who has any questions on there, I have my contact information, and they can reach out to me, and I'll be happy to help.
Give the website one more time.
LBL, earlylearninghub.org.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll.
Carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless gas that can be fatal. Don't use anything indoors that burns fuel, such as gasoline-powered generators, camp stoves and lanterns, or charcoal grills. Opening doors and windows or using fans isn't enough. Have your vents and chimneys checked to make sure water heater and gas furnace exhausts aren't blocked. If you feel sick, dizzy, or weak while using a generator, get to fresh air right away. From the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.